Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Right. Hey, guys.
So we got a lot going on. Number one, you'll probably notice the audio is back to regular because it just is. We fixed it. It is what it is.
That's a whole nother breakdown in itself. Don't get us started on that one.
We are in the mood that right now, if we don't laugh, we're probably going to fucking cry.
For anybody that didn't hear the little blurb I put on, and you probably just realized we've been missing for a little bit. We had an unexpected loss in our universe, and my soulmate, best friend in this world, passed away at 28 years old, very unexpectedly, and it's really taken us all by surprise.
MK was our biggest fan, man.
She heard the first episode before the first episode was edited, actually.
Yeah, she got the raw dog of it all.
Yeah, she got the whole thing. She's been there with us from the beginning. We've kind of like touched on it a little bit, but not really too much, that we are working with the Chattanooga Police Department on my brother-in-law's cold case. And Mary Kate was integral to that. I mean, she researched for us. Yes. She put the time in.
She's kind of the third part of this triangle of how we all got started. I mean, she was the other sounding board while we were investigating. She was combing through interviews. She was right in the thick of it with us.
And not just that. She just, it's crazy how much somebody just comes into your life. Like, I don't write salon post. I don't write podcast posts, nothing without sending it to her and being like, hey, as somebody that knows these businesses, but kind of on the outside of it, does this make sense to you? Will you read over this? Will you write me a biography? All kinds of stuff. So she was my best friend, but at the same time, I actually used to joke with her and say that on Facebook, she needed to put that she worked at Eclipsed Hair and Skin as the CMO. Because, I mean, she was our approver for everything.
Yeah.
So we are so thankful that we have so many followers. Our listener count, we were just talking about this a few minutes ago, has started to drastically shoot up lately. For the new people that are kind of coming in and not getting the best of all of us.
Right. If you're new here, we are not always this grief-stricken. And first and foremost, MK would absolutely hate that we have cried over her so much lately. And I think she would want us to keep on ticking.
And we are going to do that responsibly for us. So we are still going to get episodes out to you, but we are going to enjoy life and enjoy the summer and get ourselves healthy mentally and physically so that we can give all of ourselves to you. So there might be sometimes that they're a little bit later coming out or a little bit slower, but just know we love you guys. We know that y'all support us and we are so thankful for that. So thank you for understanding and honestly being here with us for this, because we've not really talked about this at all yet. But we'll actually
publicly,
right? Like, whenever this, the day we are recording this is the same day that the little short clip telling everybody what's going on is coming out. So I don't know what I was saying. My brain is like, if I told Randy yesterday, if you remember that commercial from the 90s that was like, this is your brain. And then they like crack the egg and it's like, this is your brain on drugs.
This is your brain on grief.
Yeah, that's me right now. So I don't even remember what I was saying, but we'll get them out. This is, we got it. We're just going to take care of ourselves.
We're doing our best, guys. And we're going to try to trudge forward as best we know how right now. And we appreciate your grace. We appreciate you guys working with us. And especially if you're new here, man, like we've been pretty freaking rigid about that schedule. Yeah. But I think losing a otherwise perfectly healthy person at the age of 28 is a little bit of a shock to the system. So you'll have to excuse us if we need to live in the moment every now and then. I think that's what it's kind of made both of us slow down a little bit.
And you are all awesome. So we know you guys will understand that and have our back.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
How about I tell you part four? Kind of part four. They've all been separate stories, but all stories that kind of roll together and come to the Dixie Mafia.
We are converging into mafia territory.
Yes. So I mentioned a few episodes ago, everybody has somebody in this area that was in the Dixie Mafia.
Yeah.
Or affiliated. So a little background on how the Dixie Mafia worked is I'm going to talk about Corksy McCord Nix Jr. today. He was considered the Dixie Mafia leader in Mississippi. I also have a case written on Billy Sunday Bird. He was Dixie Mafia leader in Georgia.
Is this regional state to state kind of thing? Like this one guy would be over the whole state? Or is it like the Atlanta chapter? And then, you know what I mean? Was it that organized? Or is it like these guys are operating and then their own syndicates and then working together to form?
Yes. Yes, they're kind of so
sort of a network more than like an organization.
Right. And I don't even think these men, like they had Kirksey and Billy both had their core guys, four or five guys, like best friends that would help them do shit.
Yeah.
And
they're wackies.
And they had other people that were associated with, kind of like the other ones. If you needed a bank robbed, you knew this guy. If you needed whiskey, you knew this guy. But I don't really think they even consider themselves really a gang. Okay. Even like with State Line Mob, I don't think they even really considered themselves a gang. I think they just thought
it was these guys doing some illegal shit.
Right. Just like-minded criminals. Yeah. Hey, this is what I like to do.
Help me and I'll help you.
Exactly. This is a Dixie Mafia story on Kirksey Nix. However, it's not the Dixie Mafia. Was everywhere. It sounds like every little town in the South that had
gambling. If your
region was
considered Dixie, you were in the Dixie Mafia if you were doing any kind of crime.
Exactly. Right. And it sounds like back then, I mean, my great-grandfather was a bootlegger.
It was like a blanket term for anybody breaking the law.
Exactly.
Or partially breaking the law.
Exactly. Like, my great-grandfather was a bootlegger, but I have talked to as many people as possible and said, you know, the term Dixie Mafia, that was not something that was talked about in their stratosphere. But the Dixie Mafia, so this is how it came to be. I touched on it a little bit at some point, I don't know. But the way it became to be is they started the RICO Act in the end of the 60s for organized crime.
Right.
These people, like the State Line Mob, the Dixie Mafia, if law enforcement gave these people that title, then they could blanket prosecute them all under the RICO Act.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's how the Dixie Mafia
they just started
legend,
labeling them.
Like, yes.
And you're in this group.
Yes. And then they could just blanket take them all down. And I think that was the easiest thing for the government. So that was like a long way to say there was Dixie Mafia.
Nobody's calling themselves the Dixie Mafia. This is a government made up.
Back in the 1970s, your uncle and your grandpa weren't sitting around talking,
Dixie Mafia. No, I'm going to run this up to Ed and he's going to take it out.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's been really interesting because my entire life, I've heard the term Dixie Mafia. I mean, obviously, Courtney was an ATF agent, my grandfather. Right. So I've always heard this term. It's something I even told my brother. I was like, I'm doing a Dixie Mafia case. Other kids weren't obsessed with it the way we were. But so the Dixie Mafia was a thing, but it wasn't really a thing. It was more of a legend and a lore than anything. Right. However, Kirksey McCord Nix Jr., this was the fucking Dixie Mafia.
I knew that.
I went through this whole spill. This man was the Dixie Mafia. And if I had to say the Dixie Mafia was to like any type of gang or anything, Kirksey Nix and Billy Burt were the Dixie Mafia.
Okay. What is their brand of criminal? All of it?
All of it.
All right.
All of it. So
tell me about it.
As the state line started to break up, they all started to disperse. And Kirksey Nix ended up in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Biloxi.
But let me tell you about his background first. He was a rotten egg from the beginning.
Ooh.
He was born in 1943, and he was actually the son of a prominent judge in Oklahoma. That did not stop him from anything. His dad's name was obviously Kirksey McCord Nix Sr.
Okay.
And he was super widely respected. He was actually both in the Oklahoma House of Representatives and the State Senate. After all that, took a bench on the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals as the chief judge. And he was the best known criminal defense lawyer in Oklahoma history.
So he was big shit.
He was big shit. And so was Kirksey's mom, Patricia.
Oh, she
was she was no less prominent than the dad was. She was actually one of the first women in Oklahoma to practice law.
Oh, she wasn't even no like socialite or no shit. She was like, fucking, I'm a lawyer.
Yes. And then they get divorced, right? She remarries to one of the wealthiest families in Oklahoma. His name was B.B. Kerr, and he was one of the founders of the Kerr-McGee Oil Company.
So they got some money.
Yes. And so now Kirksey has this super rich stepdad. His mom's a lawyer. His dad's a judge. He actually had a U.S. senator.
Essentially, you can't tell him nothing.
Yes. And even Robert Kerr, his stepdad, his brother was a senator.
Oh, okay.
So Kirksey really had everything going for him in life.
Political power, money.
And chose just to be an absolute turd.
Can't polish a turd.
You can't. But his parents were both super, like, flamboyant. They were known as overachievers.
Well, and I'm sure, I mean, when you grow up with money and political privilege back in the day, I mean, you grow up thinking your shit don't stink. You can get away with anything. Because there's not social media. Not everybody in the world's going to know about it when you go behind somebody's back and do some shady shit. That was the time of sweeping under the rugs.
So, exactly. Yeah. And his dad, you've got to remember, was this awesome criminal lawyer before he was ever a judge.
So he already knew how to get him out of everything.
Oh, and he used to take Kirksey to the jail with him. And Kirksey would make friends with these criminals.
Well, there it is.
To where the criminals would like even make him little gifts and give them to him. So from a young age, he's involved with the right people, but he's already being set up to be put in with the wrong people.
Crowd, yeah.
So as a teen, he went to jail a couple times and dropped out of high school. And he was actually already described as a con artist as a teenager.
Oh, okay.
His parents sent him to Suwanee Military Academy in Tennessee and then to New Mexico Military Institute. And he just went AWOL and came home. So he dropped out of school. And at 19, he was already charged with theft, but the charges got dropped. So I would say that probably has something to do with his parents' political power. And at 19, he's already learning. I don't have consequences.
Yeah, zero consequences to any of my actions.
So he joined the Air National Guard, which trained him in electronics. And then they sent him to Keesler for active duty for a year.
Okay.
He was a microwave radio relay repairman.
Okay.
That's a mouthful.
Whatever that is.
And he learned way many skills there.
Way a lot.
But those skills actually came, I almost said way in handy later.
Like so in handy.
You don't know how many times I have to edit myself out saying like in this.
Oh, I know. It's one of the flag words. You're the only Redneck Valley girl I know. You know that?
My whole life, I've heard people be like, where are you from?
You were raised by Paris Hilton, and that's the problem.
Clueless. I just fed into the Paris Hilton thing, but totally clueless. And honestly, MTV Spring Break, I used to watch a lot of that in elementary school, and I feel like that shows now.
Also, we've had a discussion here lately in the salon about how the children today do not know about old school MTV.
They
have no idea. They don't know about Room Raiders. They don't know about TRL. They don't know about the real world. What the fuck? You're not teaching your kids about the real world or Road Rules. They don't know where Theo Vaughn came from. They have no idea.
I used to love Road Rules. I used to love Real World. Did you?
And he was hot.
He was.
So, he's still hot. But
did you ever watch the MTV show Sorority Life? It only came on for one season. And it was like a real world, but they followed like a house of like sorority girls.
I was probably too busy watching Viva La Bam because, as we've discussed, that was my jam. And what was the one with Pontius and Steve-O?
Wild Boys.
Yes, Wild Boys. I love that because Chris Pontius.
That was a good one, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, off topic.
I was like, I looked down and was like, oh, yeah. But these skills help him later in life to crack safes. So he joined Air National Guard. He went to Keesler Air Base, learned way many skills, and later used those skills to disarm alarm systems and get into safes.
Okay.
He wasn't
just cracking safes open.
Just cracking safes open. He really wasn't interested in the National Guard. So as soon as the program was over, he left. But he really liked Biloxi.
Okay.
And his dad had connections with the underworld in Biloxi. Mm-hmm. So, and his dad, like, vacationed there a lot. And I mean, obviously, he was a criminal defense attorney. So he was probably knew not so great people and knew how to find not so great people
right
in different places. So his dad introduced him to Mike Gillich. Mike Gillich would be called the godfather of the Dixie Mafia. He owned a string of motels and nightclubs along what was later called as the Strip in Biloxi.
Okay.
And Mr. Mike, as Kirksey called him, mm-hmm. became very good friends very quickly. By the mid-60s, Kirksey was already living as a hustler. That was his bread and butter. That was his specific crime. He was a hustler. And he actually became a regular at the gambling spots and bars all over the South, like in Phoenix City, Alabama, Newport, Kentucky, and Moffat, Oklahoma. And that's how he was able to have such a vast criminal empire, is he was going to all these different areas around there. He was playing these games. He was meeting these men, you know, making his criminal connections.
Doing his fine.
And just like his parents were known to be super flamboyant, so was Kirksey Nix. He dressed and he always lived super just over the top. He always had the nicest cars, the nicest clothes. And at one time, he was at a gambling den. Mm-hmm. And they even would put cameras in the ceiling that have a person up there with a beeper. And whoever's sitting at the table, well, they're sending the messages through the beeper of what the cards are. But he was known to be super generous. He would give everyone gifts. He would come back to his neighborhood and give little things to the kids and everybody. So he was like a Robin Hood. By 1965, he and his gang broke into a summer camp near Mount Ida, Arkansas, and they stole 10 rifles, a movie projector, and sporting equipment. In 1966, he married Sandra, and they moved to Biloxi, and that's where they were living full-time in a little apartment on the beach. By now, Biloxi was a straight-up criminal haven. Like, the Strip was not known as a good place. Later that year, he was arrested for passing bag checks, then again for using illegal license plates, but he just paid the fines and would get out. Mm-hmm. Then they started a robbery spree that would span several states and would end up in murder.
Casual murder.
August 12, 1967, Sheriff Pusser gets a call at his home saying that there was a drunk that needed to be checked out. His wife was nervous about him going alone at this point. A lot of bad shit had been going on. They were about to go on vacation. He said, I'll come with you. We'll go to breakfast after. Then we'll go on vacation and everything will be fine. So they jump in their car and they're going out to New Hope Road to check out a disturbance, which these drunken disorderly calls happen all the time. He drives past the church where it was said to happen and there was nobody there. Nothing was going on. But as he passed by, a Cadillac pulled out from behind the church and followed him with the lights off.
As the two cars reached a narrow bridge, the Cadillac flashed on its headlights and came racing past Buford's car. The Cadillac opened fire, hitting Pauline in the head. So the sheriff ducked and stepped on the gas, and he sped up the road a couple of miles until he was away from it. And he pulled over to check on Pauline, and he had her head cradled in his lap. He was sitting there trying to help her. Reports say, honestly, praying that she would survive. The assassins found him, pulled up, and start shooting at him again, hitting Pusser in the face, blowing his jaw apart. It knocked him down, like, over on to her. And they actually found 14 casings at the second ambush site, and 11 of them actually hit the Plymouth. They thought he was dead by this point. Shit, I don't know how he wasn't dead by this point. But right. He grabs the radio and obviously doesn't have a jaw. Right. So he's trying to tell him what's going on. And the sheriff is on his way. He's trying to figure out where he was. He said it looked like the car had been through fucking war. It was horrible and it was bloody. Sadly, Pauline did not make it. She was dead on site. But Buford Pusser spent 18 days in the hospital and would have to have several surgeries to fix his jaw. And he couldn't come to her funeral because his jaw was literally, or like his face was held together by wire mesh. And some people criticized this poor man over the fact he didn't come to his wife's funeral. At first, he said he knew who was responsible. Towhead White, George McCann, Carmine Raymond, Gallardi, Gary McDaniel, and Kirk C. Nix. He was in the hospital for 18 days and he had dozens and dozens of surgeries to repair his face. And at the end, he was like, you know what? I said it was them, but I'm not 100% sure at this point. Like, this has been very traumatic. 4 months later in Biloxi at 3 a.m., a local nightclub owner and bookie named Harry Bennett was walking home from a poker game when he was shot 8 times. He was set to testify against 2 other crime figures, one being Kirksey. However, no one was ever charged. Kirksey says he never did anything. And still to this day, he denies this crime, but everybody says he did this to keep this guy from talking on him. In 1968, Kirksey gets arrested again, and it's for reckless driving and the unlawful use of a radio. And he had been monitoring police frequencies. The unlawful use of a radio.
Yes.
Is that still a crime?
I don't think so. Because now...
I would like to unlawfully use a radio.
Well, there's scanner app. You know, I check that app 4 times a day. Well, so
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is like,
Which makes me wonder if they're doing like State Line did, to where they had, this is where they were gambling. So they had people set up along the road and maybe they had police radios and were listening in and you weren't supposed to do that back then.
I wonder if he was like literally interfering and sending them places, like he was dispatcher.
He could have. He really could have. And he was that smart that he would have thought to do that. In 1968, he goes back to jail again. And this time, it's because they try to rob the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in Atlanta. During the robbery attempt, a guard walked in and was wounded but made full recovery. And he was able to identify them.
Okay.
They got arrested for that. So, just a month later, his father drove a dark-colored 1967 Cadillac to work and parked it in front of the state capitol in his assigned space. An hour after arriving, the car exploded, throwing metal shards all over the area. No one was hurt, and authorities quickly concluded a bomb did not cause the blast.
So what then?
That was my next thing. So what made it erupt into a ball of flames? There were a couple oxygen tanks in the trunk of the car that caused the explosion, but no one knows for sure. Many speculate this is an elaborate scheme to get rid of the Buford Pusser ambush car.
Probably.
Because it was a dark Cadillac. Only 4 months before, that same car had been included in a robbery investigation.
There we go.
At the time, it was owned by Kirksey Nix Jr. Whenever it was blown up, it had Mississippi license plates that were registered to a Doris DeAngelo. So Kirksey's car with fake plates being driven by his dad. Just
stole some lady's plates.
Probably.
Or swapped them.
But that very much sounds Kirksey shot Buford Pussard.
Yeah, it sounds like it to me.
In his car.
Yeah.
And that's how they were getting rid of it. In New Orleans, on February 18th, 1969, just before Mardi Gras, four heavily armed men in black, gloves, ski mask, all of it, raided Skibo Trailer Court just outside of New Orleans. The camp's residents ran a carnival, and they were reported to have large sums of cash on the premises. Mm-hmm. The men in black deactivated the electric perimeter fence and cut the phone lines. Mardi Gras was in full swing, so a lot of the camp's men were away working, leaving 24 women and children alone. The masked and armed gunmen broke into the house next door to the camp, and they took that family hostage. They shackled them around their necks to the couch. Then they started bringing in dozens of the camp's residents that were still there and started shackling them all together around their necks. As they were all shackled, they went and they plundered their safes, and they took about $50,000 in cash and then $8,000 in jewels. Margie George was the 44-year-old gypsy queen, probably because since they had the carnival, I'd guess they were probably gypsies. If she has money in the safe that's under her bed, and she's saying, there's not a safe under my bed.
She said, what safe?
Yeah, like she's fighting them. She's not having it. She's cursing them, and she's like trying to run away from them. So when she starts trying to run away, one of them grabs her. She starts clawing at his mask. That's when one of the men split her skull open with a hatchet.
Oh.
Nearly splitting her head in two.
Oh, my. Like a watermelon. Oh, God. I'm getting sling blade flashbacks.
When she fell to the ground, then they shot her point blank in the forehead. Other men were bringing her daughter-in-law.
This gypsy woman ain't done nothing to y'all.
Nope. Literally just living her life. They thought she just had a safe under her bed, and that's what they wanted. Jeez. At the same time as this poor woman's laying on the ground, they're bringing her daughter-in-law by. And she walks by her mother-in-law and just absolutely loses it. She is just not happy.
Yeah.
So one of the gypsy men pulled in from New Orleans as all of this is happening, and then just pulls out and speeds away. He's like, I'm going to go get the police.
Mm-hmm.
So the masked men jump in a car and start shooting at that car as it's like taken off, and they try to chase it for a little bit. And they know, shit, police are on the way. So they hightail it out of there.
Yeah.
They ditch the getaway car.
And now they've like, what? They've fucking killed her for nothing?
Yeah.
They didn't get anything?
They got a little bit of money. They got what they got out of the safes, like the $50,000 in cash and the jewelry, but they didn't get anything from her. So she's dead for literally no reason. They ditched the car. They drove on a fucking airboat they had stashed on the banks of the river. Mm-hmm. And they took it and they got on a seaplane. Half the men got on the seaplane.
Had this set up.
Oh, yeah. Half of them get on the seaplane and the other half went into New Orleans and then just blended in with the Mardi Gras crowd and was gone. The police found Margie's body propped up against the couch in her trailer, and they start immediately talking to witnesses. And it just took them 2 days to start questioning Bobby Gwynn. He denied taking part in the camp attack, but he straight up said Nix and three other men had been there. He was like, you know, it wasn't me.
He was like, wasn't me.
But I saw Nix and these three guys doing target practice.
But it was them.
At the dump. Just out at the dump shooting guns.
Just, you know, hanging out. Shooting guns at the dump.
As one does. So investigators go there and they find all the bullet casings at the dump and realize they match the ones from the gypsy camp.
Yeah.
So immediately warrants were issued for the four men, including Nix. And all of them were arrested but Kirksey.
Wonder why.
Kirksey decided to voluntarily surrender to authorities in Georgia on lesser charges.
Do you have hair dye on your toe?
I don't know what that is. I saw that. I don't know what that is. So he goes to Georgia and turns himself in on lesser charges, thinking he can skirt all this. Georgia actually refused to waive extradition to Louisiana, so he didn't have to worry about it. And while he was in jail, Gwynn, the guy that rolled over on him, was murdered. So the state lost their star witness. Without stronger evidence and no eyewitnesses, the state's case fell apart on the Margie George murder, and it wasn't solved. By the fall of 1970, he was out of jail, and he was free of any charges. He was good to go. Another hitman implicated in the gypsy camp raid, Gary McDaniel, was found dead in a river. His death was brought on by enormous controversy, and he was also rumored to be involved in the ambush of Buford Pusser on New Hope Road. So after all this happened, a group of lawmen in Dallas started to get together, and they started to figure out what to do with these traveling criminals. And this is when the name the Dixie Mafia is born.
Okay.
Richard Nixon had recently passed a law, Enforcement Assistance Act, which freed up to $3 billion for state police departments to fight this. And so this just goes back to, they were traveling criminals. Every town, every state had their own little gang. And whenever Kirksey needed anything, he would call these other head figures and be like, hey, we need an airboat, a seaplane ready in New Orleans to get us out of there. These lawmen get together and they're talking about these traveling criminals. And this is where they get the name Dixie Mafia. They give the Dixie Mafia this name, hoping that the media will pick it up and start talking about it, making the public more aware. Mm-hmm. This is around the same time that Nixon has given smaller communities $3 billion to fight these people. They were wanting to get them under the RICO Act, which I talked about at the beginning of the episode. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you this crazy story that does not involve Kirksey Nix, but it does involve the Dixie Mafia in the RICO Act.
Okay.
I'm putting this in here because I can't find any more information on this than this little blurb, but it has to do with the Allman Brothers. The first RICO Act was used against a Dixie Mafia kingpin named J.C. Hawkins. The case was out of Macon, Georgia, and involved the Allman Brothers Band. Greg Allman's former bodyguard and road manager, John Scooter Herring, was allegedly supplying the band and others with drugs.
Okay.
His ties to J.C. Hawkins had come under scrutiny by law enforcement because RICO, they're looking into this guy.
Okay.
Scooter Herring and a man named Joey were arrested and indicted. Witnesses were called in from the music industry, including Greg Allman. Everyone in the band refused to rat out their friend, but Allman, facing charges of his own, agreed to testify about the former manager.
Okay.
This was the final straw that broke the group up.
What?
The feds were happy to take down the two men, but their main target was J.C. Hawkins.
Right.
J.C. Hawkins and the crew were convicted of several racketeering charges, drug charges, and many more. During the trial, Greg Allman had to be under heavy guard, and Hawkins had put a price on Allman's head of $100,000.
Really?
Yes. Scooter was convicted of 5 drug charges and sentenced to 75 years in prison. And seeing Allman's testimony as an act of betrayal, the band officially broke up, even though they would reunite a few occasions over the decades. But that... the Dixie Mafia is what broke up the Allman Brothers.
Now we know.
And the next thing in my note was, this has nothing to do with it. It was just a really cool story to share. Back to Kirksey. After his release from prison, he and his wife moved to New Orleans.
Okay.
And she opened up a photography studio, and she catered to clients of a beauty shop that was nearby. And she was making $1,400 a shoot.
Holy shit.
And then Kirksey invested in a portable dumpster business. And he was actually meeting in Ecuador about opening a casino in the Galapagos Islands. April 10th / 11th, because it was really late at night. Mm-hmm. And it was the night before Easter in 1971. The home of Frank Corsco was forcibly entered by 3 armed men. They were coming in to rob him. He was a successful businessman that owned a string of grocery stores, so it was rumored that he had a lot of money in his house. Him, his wife, and his 3 children were all at home at the time. His wife was looking out the kitchen window when she saw a man coming into the back door of her home. So she ran down the hall screaming for her husband to get the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Frank had been asleep in the back room. So he grabbed a pistol and he went through the house to confront the burglars. And she ran to the bedroom and shut the door. Gunfight ensued with Frank and the men. And Frank was shot 4 times in the stomach.
Oh, my.
One of the gunmen was also shot. So the men fled from the residence, followed by Miss Corsco, who had retrieved the weapon and was firing at them. She shot at him twice.
Okay.
The one who was wounded was assisted from the house by the other men, and the phone line had been cut, so they actually family ran into the street and stopped cars to get help to him.
Good night.
At the back door, the police found a metal hydraulic jack that had been used to force open the door. And on the patio, they found a leather bag full of burglary tools. In the gutter across the street, they found a 9mm gun with a bullet lodged in the chamber.
Ah, the gun jammed.
The gun jammed. Neighbors reported seeing the men loading a wounded man into a 1967 blue Ford Mustang. The police start calling around hospitals and airports to see if they could track down the wounded man. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. An airport reported that they saw a man and woman boarding a plane to Dallas. New Orleans police realized that the pilot was a Dixie Mafia friend named Travis Stallcup. So they called Dallas, and Dallas was like, hey, yeah, no, some wounded man just landed here. So as soon as he had landed, the wounded man, he'd went straight to the hospital, and the police
went... They were just trying to get him out of the area so that... They wouldn't track him down.
Dallas police showed up to the hospital and found...
Surprise, motherfucker!
Kirksey Nix. They had a warrant for the bullet, and they actually went in...
They said, I want that bullet out of your body.
They did. And they did an x-ray. It was stuck in his pelvis, and it was a .32 caliber that was the same as Frank's gun. So at this point, they're like,
got
okay,
that ass.
This is you. So they have Kirksey Nix, John Fulford, Peter Mule, and getaway driver James Knight.
Okay.
James Knight was granted immunity for his testimony. The other three were tried jointly for murder and robbery. Kirksey's father joined the defense team, and the trial was moved to Lafayette because they were like, oh, we can't get a fair trial in New Orleans. Mm. So Kirksey says that he was with his wife the night of the murder, and the next day, a man named Mike shot him over money. Mike was unable to verify the story, and the reason why was because he had been killed in a police shootout the summer before.
Okay.
When asked how he ended up in the Dallas hospital, Kirksey said Mike had shot him the day before and was scared that if he went to the New Orleans hospital, they would connect the shooting to Mike. The problem is, police had found a map underneath Kirksey's bed with a big black X where the Corsos lived. May 10th.
Not looking good.
It only took the jury 2 hours to reach a verdict.
There we go.
And all three were found guilty without capital punishment and sentenced to life in prison. And Kirksey was sentenced to life in hard labor at the state penitentiary, also known as Angola, or the bloodiest prison in American history. Once again, he still denies he had nothing to do with this murder. And sadly,
sure,
at the same time, his wife was killed in a car accident. So by the end of 1980, Mike Gillich, or the boss of Biloxi, had aided in various schemes for Kirksey Nix. And, oh, hold on, before I get to this. So Kirksey Nix is in prison for life. And that seems where our story's going to end, right?
Never.
Never. By the end of the 1980s, Mike Gillich, the boss of the Mississippi Dixie Mafia, had aided Nix in many schemes, and they had an attorney named Pete Hallett. Pete maintained a trust for Nix's and Nix's girlfriend, Larae Sharp, worked out of Hallett's office to help Nixey with his appeals. There was a safety deposit box in which they just kept the cash that Nix was still generating from his operations, and he had actually acquired hundreds and thousands of dollars through a scam known as the Lonely Heart Scam. So what Kirksey would do was he would pose as a buff young stud named Eddie Johnson, complete with a fake photo. And he would seduce lonely gay men into sending him cash to help with his legal defense, promising true love whenever he was freed. He would hit them with hard pity parties about how he had been wrongly convicted because he was gay and how he was mistreated because he was gay in prison. But he was not. He was just playing these men, and dozens of men wired money to Eddie via Western Union offices. Mm-hmm. a Midwest postal carrier took out a second home mortgage and sent $100,000 to Nix. West Coast News reporter sent $20,000. But to make matters worse, you've got to think this is the early 80s. So after they would send him this money, he would turn around and fucking blackmail the men that were still in the closet into sending him even more money and like threaten to expose them if not. So there was really no way of knowing how many people he took advantage of because some people never came forward because they were scared they were going to get outed by this man. So what he did was he put all this together and they would put the money he got from this in the safe deposit box. Mm-hmm. Whose name was on the box, right? Pete Hallett and Nix's girlfriend, Lorae Sharp. The plan was to just store the money to buy him, you know, legal favors. Well, Hallett became greedy and stole $500,000 from the box. He moved the cash to a box assigned to him and his law partner, Judge Sherry, to cover his tracks. So then if Nix noticed that the money was missing, he would blame it on the judge. Well, Nix realized the money was missing.
And he blamed
on the judge. Before Vincent Sherry was appointed a circuit judge in 1986, him and Hallett had made a huge living off of defending Mike Gillich, the underboss. So they had been Hallett and Sherry had been law partners starting in 1981. Margaret, Judge Sherry's wife, was a city councilwoman, and she was about to run for mayor. She was super vocal about her stand against illegal gambling and everything that came with the casinos. Because you've got to think, this is Biloxi before all of this was legal. So she's wanting to get all this out, get it done with. He was actually a very devout Democrat, and she was a very devout Republican. And when people would ask them, how do y'all make it work? She'd say, well, he's the only person that I see worthy to argue with. And I think that's really cute of them. Monday, September 14th, 1987, in Biloxi, Mississippi, Margaret Sherry was on the phone. Her conversation was just cut off mid-sentence. And she was about to say goodnight to her friend, Diane. This was a little after 7 p.m. Vince had been kind of messing around in the background saying he was hungry and her friend could hear him. But then a minute or two later, it just went dead. So she's thinking, oh, my God, Margaret was known to be super chaotic and all over the place and late and just crazy. So she's thinking, OK, he's hungry. She was just getting off the phone. That's fine. Didn't think anything about it. Well, sometime after that phone conversation at 7 p.m., I'm going to assume the phone lines were cut and that's why it stopped. But maybe somebody just walked in. Nobody completely knows what happened that night. But after 7 p.m., a gunman entered the upscale home in the Ancient Oak subdivision and shot the couple with a .22 caliber pistol. The judge was shot several times in his living room, still literally dressed in the clothes he wore earlier that day to court. Margaret was shot several times, and she was found near the bed in the couple's bedroom. From what I understand, it looks like she was probably getting undressed in front of a mirror in the bedroom, and someone came in and surprised her as she was. So kind of what's speculated is that she was back in their back bedroom starting to get undressed. Judge Sherry was up front. Someone knocked on the door and he had answered it. The perpetrator did not steal anything at all, including his wallet, her purse, or the jewelry that was in the house on them. Nothing was taken. What surprised investigators more that there was no break-in, nothing missing, anything, was they had found signs of a telltale professional hit. There were pieces of foam by Vincent's body that was common substance that was used to make a silencer during this time. The judge had actually canceled his court appointments for the day because they were going to go out of town. It actually took 2 days for anyone to go look for them because no one knew they were missing. It actually was all because the judge didn't arrive at court that morning. So somebody called Peter and was like, hey, you used to be partners with him. That's your buddy. Will you go check on him?
That's your boy. Go look.
And once again, Vince was known for his tardiness. So people were like, that's fine. It's even said that he was known to live on Hong Kong time. But they were even like, no, this is, he normally at least shows up for work. Like, this is weird. Yeah. So Pete heads that way and he takes one of their co-workers with him. I'm going to guess like a paralegal. And when Pete gets to the house, he notices that both cars are in the driveway. He knocked on the door. No one answered, but he could hear the dogs barking inside. He leaned and was peering through the window and the door. And he says, as his weight shifted, his elbow just pushed open the door. After seeing Vincent, he ran outside and told the man, call the police. The judge and Margaret are dead. The judges and public officials were actually even at this time being guarded by law enforcement because no one knew why they were targeted. They canvassed the neighborhood. They asked them everything, but no one would give them anything. Nobody had seen anything. And not just that, people were scared. This was a gated community. Right. How does somebody come in and kill these two people? So 12,000 people attended their funerals. And Pete Hallett wasn't scheduled to speak at the service, but he chose to stand and speak anyway.
Oh, okay.
His highly long-winded speech seemed more of a campaign speech for his upcoming mayor campaign. And he rallied about corruption and blood. He rallied about the corruption in Biloxi and very little actually even spoke of the Sherrys. So their daughter Lynn starts her own investigation, and she realized that people are a little bit more comfortable talking to her than they were the police. In a neighbor.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because, I mean,
they don't know how deep this goes.
And exactly, because you couldn't trust anybody back then. Right. So a neighbor told her that there was a strange car in the area the night that her parents were killed. So she took the information directly to the police and the FBI. Within a week, the authorities found an abandoned yellow 1981 Ford Fairmount that matched the description. The interior light of this car had been purposely dismantled and the bulb had been removed.
Oh, okay.
And so obviously they're like, this is suspicious. And the vehicle had been stolen the day before the murders had taken place and the license plates had been changed out. They found the car abandoned in an apartment complex. And it was managed by Lenny Sweatman. The name Sweatman started setting off alarm bells, not just because his name was Sweatman. But he was
That's suspicious alone.
But he was actually a well-known member of the Dixie Mafia.
Okay.
So they're like, okay, ding, ding, ding. He claimed to have called a friend over from the strip for car parts before having this car towed away. And he doesn't have any clue what it was. He had just kept the plates.
Okay.
So by this point, the police department claimed they had no more leads. And Hallett was elected mayor in 1989. And people were really hopeful that with him as mayor, these deaths would be solved. This same time is when a new task force started to take over and kind of look over the evidence. And in recordings, Vincent Sherry had claimed he had received threats in the months leading up to the murder, but he didn't give any details about the threats. Always give details. If somebody threatens you, give very precise details on how these people are threatening you.
Yeah.
The detective started combing through the phone records of Hallett's office, his law office, and they discovered 345 calls between the law office in Angola.
Just a couple.
From December 8, 1986 until the day after the Sherry murders.
Not communicating about anything at all.
No. So the detectives interviewed secretaries, former secretaries, and they said that Hallett would speak to Kirksey Nix on the phone often, daily, always with his door shut. So Hallett explained that the calls were just a law aid and that, you know, he was just helping Kirksey. And prison records showed that Hallett had visited Nix the same time the phone calls had began. And this is when law enforcement started to kind of figure out the Lonely Hearts scheme. And they start hearing word of this.
He's got some splaining to do.
So it starts looking like it's going to go stagnant again, but their daughter, the Sherry's daughter, Lynn, just keeps pushing forward. She's like, this is not going to happen.
No, hell no, we're doing this.
So she hired a private investigator, an ex-state trooper named Rex Armistead. Rex sounds like a private investigator name, and I'm here for it.
Rex Armistead.
But Rex was a legend in the South, because with a name like Rex, how could you not be a legend in the South?
It is written that you have to be a legend.
He drove a Cadillac and was known to carry a pearl-handed pistol, as he should.
Yeah, he did.
As he should.
That checks.
So he had spent most of his law enforcement career tracking down Dixie Mafia and was actually even credited with giving it its name. But he cost $50,000 at the time.
$50,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
She paid it and he started looking into the case and he was trying to get the FBI involved. This is before they're involved. He's still trying to get them involved.
So he's trying to push to get them to look.
Yes. So he just kind of on a hunch, you know, he's worked with these Dixie Mafia figures. He kind of knows what's up about it.
Yeah.
He went to Angola and he visited a man named Bobby Joe Fabian.
Okay.
Bobby was serving a life sentence for kidnapping. And he was hoping, like any other prison yard informant, he's wanting time off.
Right. His goal is a reduced sentence.
Right. The funny thing is, Rex is actually the one that had put him in jail for that charge. So, December 1986.
He said, hey, I'll take it back.
Right. You help me, I'll help you. So, he finds out in December 1986 that Nix had learned that $100,000 of his money was missing from this box.
Okay.
Nix called in Hallett for a prison sit-down, and Hallett blamed Vince Sherry, as he said he was going to. So Fabian also told Rex that a known hitman named John Ransom was the one that had killed the Sherrys. Bill Rhodes was an associate of Ransom, and he had turned state's evidence and claimed that he was the getaway driver. He says that he met with Mike Gillich and Pete Hallett several months before, and that he was to drive and Ransom was to kill the Sherrys, but the plan fell through when Ransom was arrested.
Okay.
So, Ransom had actually provided the weapon to kill the judge and his wife, but was not the trigger man.
Okay.
Bobby told investigators that Lorraine, the girlfriend working in Hallett's office, was in on the whole thing. And she was actually even getting special permission to go visit Kirksey at Angola. John Ransom's name was already pretty familiar because he was linked to many Dixie Mafia crimes. So, Lorraine confessed to playing a limited role in the scam. Okay. She just would say that she was just a paralegal trying to help out. She was just trying to get him out of jail. But phone records would show that there were three-way calls between Angola, Lorraine, and John Ransom.
Right. So, it's clearly she was part of the scheme.
Right. So, Bobby Joe Fabian, was to be transferred out of Angola. But a Florida boss of the Dixie Mafia named Jeffrey Carter had managed to be assigned to exactly where Fabian was being housed. So at this point, Fabian's freaking out. And he's even been told, Jeffrey Carter has a knife. He's coming to kill you.
Ooh.
Angola security immediately reacted to the information and got Bobby Joe Fabian out of there. When they searched Jeffrey Carter, they actually did find a buck knife open. So he really was going to go kill Bobby Joe Fabian.
Roro.
Well, in 1989, Bobby Fabian's name was leaked to the papers.
Uh-oh.
So at this point, he's like, my only chance of living is to be loud.
Like, yeah, like essentially he's fucked unless he's like, yeah, here it is.
So he goes on TV and he does an interview. And he says, Peter Hallett knew that somebody was going to die and better be Sherry than him. He also publicly said Peter is the one that stole the money from Kirksey. Hallett was threatening to sue the TV stations for slander because he was saying he had nothing to do with this. So at this point, the FBI is like, hold on a second. He's the mayor now. There's a lot going on. Okay, you've got our attention. We're involved. And it turns out the scam had already been on the FBI's radar for 3 years before the murder.
Interesting.
But they were not going to investigate it for a few reasons.
Okay, hit me with it.
One, The perpetrators were already in custody with lengthy sentences, so they saw no time in wasting resources.
Like why waste money on people that are not getting out again?
Two, the men were being scammed were gay men, and since they were a marginalized society, the police did not take it seriously that a crime had even been committed.
In some parts of the country, it was probably still illegal to be gay.
Exactly, and we're in Biloxi, Mississippi, right, in the South. So this is the reason that they were like, I mean, we've known about this, but we didn't take it very seriously.
Absolutely, fuck off with that.
And if you would have, these two people would have been alive.
Exactly.
So in 1991, federal prosecutors brought charges against Nix and Mike Gillich for the conspiracy for the murders. And they didn't charge Hallett yet because the case would have been all on Bobby Joe Fabian. And well, he's already a con, so they knew that his testimony was going to be weak for him. So they kind of held off a little bit. Good thing they did, because Mike Gillich turned government witness as soon as he was caught.
Shocking.
His girlfriend, Frances Salisbury, was about to get charged. So he told his side of the story and spoke in great detail, even saying the hitman put super glue on his fingers so he wouldn't leave prints behind in the house. He also provided the name of the actual trigger man, and that Thomas Leslie Holcomb was offered $20,000 to kill the Sherrys. He gave numerous details about the crime, including that the bullets were bought at Kmart.
Show me the money!
He was actually released from prison in July 2000 after serving 9 years of his 20-year sentence, but then died of cancer in 2012. Kirksey McCord Nix, the Dixie Mafia kingpin, and Thomas Holcomb received life sentences. John Ransom was convicted for supplying the gun and served 2 years in state prison on an unrelated manslaughter charge.
What year are we in right now?
91.
Mm-hmm. We started the story back in the 20s. Right? Yeah. And now we are in 91.
Yeah.
Right before I come screaming into the world. That's kind of crazy how far this spans.
That's why I was like, I can't just tell this story without telling the ones before it to see, like, this corruption is kind of what built a lot of these areas.
Yeah.
So, finally, Pete Hallett was convicted on October 23rd, 1996. He was sentenced to 18 years in prison. And at the trial, the man that went on to discover the Sherry's body says that Pete was only inside the house for seconds. So when he came out and said the judge and Margaret had been murdered, there's physically no way he could have known that Margaret was dead too. So Pete Hallett was actually released in 2013 after serving 15 years, and he still proclaims he's innocent. Still says he has nothing to do with it. Kirksey Nix is currently incarcerated at the Federal Correctional Institute in El Reno. He still claims his innocence in this case, and he actually claims that there was never any money missing, and there was never any reason to kill the Sherrys.
Other than the fact that you now realize that you absolutely fucked up, and it was hell.
Yeah. It was. Like, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, this is actually Gone South, seasons 1 and 2 are both. The season 1 talks a lot about Kirksey Nix and goes even more into detail about some stuff. And season 2 is actually about the Sherry murders, because he didn't even realize the connection between the two whenever he started recording for Kirksey Nix. Wow. But this is just another story of a man allowed to get away with everything. I feel like that's something every one of these leaders we've talked about in all these episodes, from a young age, they've always been allowed to get away with things. Mm-hmm. And that's been an ongoing theme in all of this. But that is the story of the Dixie Mafia.
Wild as hell, y'all.
Wild as hell. I'm so glad. I actually have still more Dixie Mafia cases. I told y'all I was going to do these for forever.
So we have some spinoffs, but we don't necessarily have to do them in a clump anymore.
Right. This story just rolled so good into the Stateline Mob because of everything. And I feel like
you needed all of it. to really understand.
That's what I told you that day I came and jumped in your car. I was like, okay, so not to take over, but I have four episodes because I can't tell one story without telling another story. But Kirksey Nix being so heavily involved in the Stateline mob just shows that, I mean, I think
it was all connected.
It was all a web. It was all a spider web back then.
A big, huge web. Yeah. A big old net.
A big old net of criminals. So, all right, guys, we made it through.
If nobody else told you today, we love you.
Yes, and if the hardest thing you do is get out of bed today, well, you're brave for getting out of bed.
We did it. You can do it, too.
You can do it. Bye, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.